Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wiggling.
Yeah, this is Cassidy the Hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dallas, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We are now tuned in at episode 463. We knocking them down like dominoes. I'm your host of the evening, King Eric the Media Assassin, and you are now tuned in to Off the Cuff Radio, and this show is sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, Jesse's Boutique, Core Financial, Fleetwood and the Cotton Pickers, the Screwball Radio. I got my host T-Max with the facts in the building.
What it do, y'all? Another Super Sunday of OTCF in the building. Shout out to our co-host on Sierra La Sandman, Lady Chinchilla, and Pittsburgh Pat, of course. We are live and direct, and tonight on this Sunday, it is truly special. We are divinely blessed. King, this guest we have tonight, to call him a legend is an understatement. To call him an MC is just, mere words cannot appropriately describe this man's artistry, his integrity, his contributions, and just being so integral, so instrumental, so influential, and such a part of our lives growing up, being of that 90s nostalgia. You know, he's one of the true kings of Queens, indeed. Flushing, stand up. This is a son of yours and an icon to us. Without further ado, y'all, Mike Geronimo, welcome.
Wow, that was crazy. Like, damn, you will make me cry, man. Those shit in there like that. That's something.
Hey,
what up, though?
Hey, you know what, bro? I would tell you this, man. T-Max is a master of doing that, man. Like, man, he'll give you that proper Michael Buffer intro. He make you feel like a superhero.
I swear to God, I was like, damn, I need like a robe and some boxing gloves on right now, man. Like, damn, nigga, I'm fighting for my belt right now. That's what's up.
Nigga, you the title holder of Tremendous, man. So the undisputed champ.
Yeah, we taking you on a road.
For every show.
Hell, man. It's an honor to be here, though. That's a heck of a way to start. I'm very sincerely appreciative. Thank you so much, man. It's a pleasure to be with y'all, man.
Dude, thank you so much.
Mike. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Mike, this is another legendary entry in our chapter of radio journalism, being the curators of the culture, with you being another excellent entry for us. We're so honored. I sent King some stuff earlier, and I dropped it in your IG as well. You know, we see T-Max and VA, check it out, because that's not even all the stuff I have. That's just what I was digging through. I didn't even get to that actual blunt recording. I didn't even get to the Blunt Recordings promo cassette that did that made it around a little bit with Kim Swain.
Yeah. Shout out to Kim. Yeah, that's what's up.
Yeah, man. I guess we, you know, we do it like we do right about this time. I mean, welcome.
Before we get started, man, I got to say this, though. And this, I got to get my hand off to this dude right here for the simple fact. I checked your Twitter. Thank you for G-checking Kid Rock, man. I don't like that dude, man. I'm glad somebody in the culture fuck out for this shit. That dude one of the corniest dudes ever, man. I'm glad somebody act like...
You know what it was, like, on some red, yo, look, first off, it was the wrong night, because, you know, I was acting with the fellas, and we, you know, I had a couple of drinks, I'm looking at my top line, I'm seeing all this weirdo shit from Kid Rock, and I was just like, you know what, I just don't like him, and I never did, so the hell with it, and I just said what I felt. You know, but
that's hip hop, man.
Yeah, you gotta call it like you gotta call it like you see it. You know, but then again, he put it out there, so you know, if you wanna put it out there, you gotta take it the way you dish it. You know, so it is what it is.
Yeah. That's why I wanna hit that like button like 80 times before going on the air. Him and that little biscuit in that whole era, that made me sick to my stomach. So I was like, good, I'm glad somebody spoke out on that shit.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. Like, I just don't understand, you know, like, if that's how you felt about it, then wow, did you feel that way when you were trying to be a rapper? You understand what I'm saying? Like, was that your view of us when you was trying to get a record deal and it didn't work out and then you turned into this rock star and now all of it's like, it's all bullshit. You understand what I'm saying? But
yeah.
I don't want to get too caught up in like,
I just
want to
just put
really
that out there.
Deserve.
That's an acknowledgement,
right? Right.
But you know, it is what it is. I feel you on that, bro. Real talk.
Yeah.
One thing about it is that with the culture, we, this is something, you know, that is near and dear to us, and there's enough room in it because hip hop culture is a creative one. So there's enough room for everybody, no matter who you are, no matter what gender, no matter what color, you know, as long as you respect it, you know. But the problem is that you have some people that treat it more as a passing fad of how they're able to capitalize monetarily than how they're going to contribute artistically. And I think it's not just limited to Kid Rock, who basically just looks nothing more like a poser and a fucking fraud at that. You know, like I said, we're not going to spend a whole bunch of time swinging a sledgehammer on an ant that's irrelevant. You know, dumping boots down the hill.
Mike Geronimo, man.
Honestly, put long story short with it, I just didn't appreciate him being so vocal in terms of being one of these people that's out here misguiding people with the climate in the country and all the misinformation and just the idiot shit. You understand what I'm saying? And
right.
The way I feel about it is, it just feels like there's too much of a microphone for all the wrong things. And if that's the type of time that you want, and that's not what we need as a people, as a country, as a nation, as a world, that ain't what we need. But if that's the type of time you want, nigga, somebody got to tell you that somebody else is on a different type of time. You feel me? So
exactly.
You know, his beliefs, what he subscribes to, that's on him. It's everybody ain't for everything, and everything ain't for everybody. So I'm just the opposing force, you feel me? And that's it. And that's all there is to it, you know?
Well, there's all, definitely, and one thing about the universe in its uniqueness and its divine creation is that there's always going to be negative energy, but there always has to be that proactive, pragmatic, positive energy like yourself that is always going to be about being solutions-oriented. One thing about your music that it has reflected over so many years is a realism, a vulnerability, and a real sense of sincerity. I remember when I first heard Shit's Real back in 1995, and it's, you know, and I tell the youngins today, when you look at the era of which we grew up in, there's certain songs, you know, that there was an organic growth to it. There sometimes wasn't a big rollout. There wasn't necessarily, you know, it was just DJs, really, when you look at the radio during that time, DJs had they didn't have a playlist. It was all about what was dope. And you just have some songs that just come into the rotation out of nowhere. And you just, you know, out in the, you know, you just out about bobbing and weaving, doing what you do, and then all of a sudden you hear something, and it just literally just makes you freeze, like you've been shot by Captain Cold, and it's like, yo, this is some ill shit. And that was how I think we all collectively felt when we heard Shit's Real drop in '95. I mean, you literally came in with something that we were like, this dude is destined for great things.
Wow.
But before all of this, I mean, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, coming from Flushing, you know, and we'd be remiss to not shout out Farmers, you know, Hollis, you know, Jamaica, Southside.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Jamaica side.
Corona.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. Left Rack, Cute Queens.
Yeah.
Astoria, Bayside, like, every part of Queens. I mean, me, bro, like, That's mostly what I knew my entire life was Queens, you know, and it's a very down to earth place. Like, we're actually I think we have the most diversity of any county in the United States. So any nationality literally that exists in the world you can find in Queens, New York. So you know, just coming from that, and it's a working class borough, you know, so coming from that, you just saw so many different sides of life and so many different takes on life and all of that just wrapped together, I guess, you know, it's a big part of who I am, you know, and yeah, I grew up in Flushing. My mom worked for Ebony. My dad was a cop. My mom passed away early on, so, you know, I did a lot of moving around, and I have family in Jamaica, so I spent a lot of time bouncing back and forth between Flushing and between Jamaica, you know, and then I have family, too, in East Elmhurst and Corona, so I was just all over the place growing up in Queens, you know, and I was just lucky enough to grow up and live next to Lord's Professor. Shout out to him. And he was like,
yes,
really
LP.
The first person. Yeah, LP. Like, Lord's was like the first person I ever really even knew coming outside of my house. So it just was weird, bro. You know, and then as we got older, he was into music. So I was able to be around him and meet all these people that, you know, I idolized and soak up all of this music that was coming from him and, you know, the people he was working with, and it just all led to where it led to. And that's about it, you know. That's about it.
Now, and to give our listeners out there, this is how much you have to understand the legacy of legends that this man is cut from. This is a short list of it.
Let him know.
I mean, this is the short list of it. When you think about QB alone, Queensbridge Houses, 96 buildings, 15,000 residents, the largest housing project in the country, if not the world. In terms of that, you got Black Poet, you got Kami, you got Capone and Noriega, you got Lakey the Kid, some guy named Nas. I think y'all heard of him too. You know, Mom, you know, V12,
yeah.
You know, Cormega. Yeah. You know, you take it to Queens, you know, Hollis, the legendary you know, Run DMC. Rest in peace, Jam Master J. You take it to Farmers. You know, some guy, you know,
yeah.
You know, Todd James Smith, LL Cool J. I think y'all know him as that. I mean, you know, I mean, Corona, my favorite MC of all time, Cool G Rap.
Cool G Rap, facts, yeah.
I mean, dude, it's like.
It was a lot, yeah.
Yes.
It's a lot. And people don't get, like, because, like, when I was a kid, like my cousin ran with DJ Polo. So I knew Polo when I was a kid, you know, and, like, just going to high school, like, a lot of Lost Boys went to high school with me. And, you know, my man J-Raph, shout out to Raph. Raph was, like, the second person I knew in life growing up with. So I always was connected to Lost Boys, and I was always connected to, like, that side of Queens. And so it's weird because, you know, just going through high school or just living your everyday existence, we all came across each other's paths all the time. You know, Fleshman, mm-hmm. Capone cousins, so Capone and Nori would be in our neighborhood, we would be in their neighborhood. You know, we knew everybody from Queensbridge, they would come to our neighborhood, vice versa. So we all got to, you know, share each other's energies at some point. And, you know, now being older and looking back at it, is it wild? Yeah, it's kind of wild to be at that place at that time and be able to be a part of a movement that you didn't even know was coming. You understand what I'm saying? So it's just, I'm just honored to, you know, been in existence at that place at that time and, you know, be able to say that that's what led me to where I'm heading now. So it's a privilege. And
you know what, man? I gotta ask you. Every time we have somebody of your caliber from the New York, that time frame in New York City, I gotta ask everybody that question. I gotta ask you about the tunnel, my mm-hmm. man. The tunnel. If Kim asked me where I'm going with this. Care to tell everybody that's, you know, currently listening to this show right now what the tunnel life was like? Like, let us know what was going down there.
You know, it's funny because not too long ago, I think it was my brother and one of my friends, and we were just having a conversation about, like, all the wild stuff that we saw or, you know, or that happened in the tunnel. And like I said, when you get older, you know, and if you allow yourself to grow, you'll look back and you'll be like, damn, like, I can't believe we made it out of that, or I can't believe we saw that. The tunnel was like the jungle. Like, the tunnel was like, it was like a thugged out Studio 54. Like, that's the only way to put it. Like,
man.
I mean, if you could have put girls and music on Rikers Island, that's what the tunnel is. So the tunnel was like, you know, you want to have a good time, but at the same time, you like, all right, we going into the jungle right now. So it had those things about it where it was just amazing. Like, there were performances I seen that I'll never forget. There was, like, you know, nights that they had that were just legendary. And then they had, you know, you had the other stuff, and like, yeah, I remember when that happened and that was crazy, or, you know, lucky we got out of that one. So, I mean, if you can imagine Welcome to the Terror Dome being a nightclub, that's what the tunnel was. You know, that's what the tunnel was. But again, it's cool to sit back now after all these years and reminisce and say, you know, I'm glad that I was in that place at that time to experience, you know?
Definitely. King and myself
always... Hey, T-Bex, hold on one second. I got Pat on the line right now.
Okay, what up, Pat?
Yo, what's going on, guys?
Hey.
I can't stick around long. I'm watching my nieces and shit, but I had to call in real quick. Because Mike Geronimo is in my Hall of Fame for sure. I also have a little announcement to make. February 21st, 9 p.m. Eastern, Off the Cuff Radio. We have a guest coming on that I'm pretty sure Mike Geronimo knows this guy, none other than Royal Flush. So
yes.
I think Mike Geronimo is familiar with that guy a little bit.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, a little sight, a little sight. You know, that's
pretty
cool.
Sure
though.
He appeared seven times on the Natural. He appeared seven times on the Natural.
That's left arm, right arm. You already know. So it's good to hear that. That's what's up. Shout out to Flood.
Yeah, for sure. But look, man, I'm gonna just hit you with just like two quick questions, and then I'm gonna let these guys take back over the interview. My first question, I'm gonna preface it like this: I'm from Pittsburgh. In football, we just seen Ben Roethlisberger retire, and I think Tom Brady retired too. So like, it made me think like, damn, that's like that's my football, like my you know, that's what I grew up on was the Steelers, Ravens, Peyton Manning, Tom Brady's crazy games.
The end of the network.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, then you look now and you see like Cincinnati just made the playoffs, and you see like Patrick Mahomes and everybody.
I'm trying to figure it out now, bro.
So it's a lot different. So the way I'm going to relate it to how I, like, what I wanted to ask you is, you have a legendary remix to one of your tracks with Black Rob and DMX. And with both of them just passing recently, more and more, of course, we lost Biz Markie. We've been losing a lot of guys. Prodigy's gone and all that. Like, it's starting to feel like our hip-hop is going away slowly and slowly. But so as a veteran and a Hall of Famer, what role do you, or you know, what can we do to keep this alive? Like, what do we do to keep our hip hop? What, you know, because a lot of people say this ain't your father's hip hop no more. But like, we do have a place on the stuff we grew up on. So like, the deaths of those guys are definitely felt. I miss all those guys dearly. I'm sure you do too, because you knew them personally. But as somebody of your stature, you know, how do you take that? What do you do to keep our hip hop alive?
I just, you know, I get where you're coming from, and I think that I said to somebody not too long ago. I said when you get older and you start losing people, it starts to, like, you're not just sad you're losing those people, but it kind of jars you because it reminds you of your own mortality. And you know, I think it's just a part of, it's kind of the trade-off with being able to say that you graduated to another stage in life. You know, you unfortunately see a lot of things and a lot of people, you know, they leave early, and that scares us all. But when you have something that's of the force of what hip hop is, and you especially have that point in time, that era that we came from, pardon me, some things are just so, it's so much larger than life that you don't ever have to worry about them disappearing, because they were so much larger than life. And I think hip-hop, and I think in particular that era that we came from, was so much larger than anything anybody could have ever expected, that you're never going to have to worry about that ever disappearing.
Yeah,
I think,
you know, well,
honestly put, if you give it enough time, and I think that's the biggest problem with the world today is patience. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if you give things enough time, then people start to come around. And what I mean by that is, in the same way that over the years the Rolling Stones have had fans that were with them from day one, but then they ended up getting fans that weren't even born when they came out, hip-hop is going through that, man. You understand what I'm saying? And there's no way that you won't
50 years from now hear someone talking about Biggie, or you won't hear about DMX, or you won't hear about Jay-Z or Ja Rule or any of those artists, any of us that came from that era, because as a Wu-Tang, like, it was just so much larger than life itself that you don't ever have to worry about that ever going anywhere. Like, it's just a staple in the timeline of not just, not just, and it's not just like 40
years from now,
it changed the world.
I didn't mean to cut you out, but 30 years from now, I could put on, like, Whoa from Black Rob, and people will still understand why that was such a dope record. It's still a fun record, to where, like, you don't even really necessarily got to, like, rap music to, like, feel the vibe of that record.
To feel the vibe of it, exactly.
And it's like, damn.
I watch my kids do it, bro. My kids are 10, they're 10, 7, and, I mean, 10, 8, and 6 years old, and my youngest son listens to DMX damn near every day.
With DMX, he's an icon. He transcends hip-hop. There's only a few guys that, like, have fan bases of people that don't even like rap music. You know what I mean? And he's one of them. Like, skateboarders listen to Rough Riders Anthem. You know what I'm saying? Like,
Exactly. Like, you could go to a football game and you're going to hear Rough Riders Anthem, and I think, like I said, that's bigger than hip hop. That's bigger than everything. That transcends so many different things. So it will have its place, and I think it's actually gonna become fortified the more that time goes on. You know, so I won't worry about it. Boy.
In the year 2060, Shook Ones will still be dope. You know what I'm saying? Like,
absolutely.
You know, Rough Riders Anthem will still be the, you know, you'll still be able to get the stuff dropped.
You'll
be able
to hear
be ill. You know, 40 years from now.
And nothing can change that.
I'm an East Coast head, bro. I'm an East Coast. Everybody knows me because I fuck with New Orleans and I fuck with the East Coast heavy.
That's what's up.
I'm going to ask you your top five queens of all time, and I'll give you mine afterwards, but I need your top five queens all time.
That's hard, bro. Damn, because no matter.
Bro, I was telling somebody this the other day. I could give you a top five without naming Nas, and I mean, like, you know, I want to give Nas his props and put the crown on his head. He's in my top five, but I could give you five rappers you really couldn't argue with that are top five worthy for Queen. That's how dope Queens is.
Right, you could, but it wouldn't even be right. So
definitely not. Like I said,
Nas,
he's in my top five for sure.
Yeah, he would definitely be one in my top five for certain. Kool G Rap would definitely be another one in my top five.
He's number one on my
list. LL is definitely in my top five from Queens. Prodigy is in my top five. I mean, really, you got to count Mobb Deep as just one person. I know they two, but you got to count them as one.
I need one more.
Who else? I need one more from Queens.
Yeah.
That's hard. I'm trying to think of somebody who, like, Pain Game is just phenomenal. Like, and I know I'm forgetting someone definitely.
I'll give you my five. My five is G-Rap.
Come back to the last one.
Mine's G-Rap, Nas, Prodigy. These are the two that I thought you would name them, bro, to be honest with you. But I'm going to say Mega, and I'm going to go with Tragedy.
Yeah,
I'm
going
to put Tragedy in my
top five. And that's the thing. I would say Trag, but then I'm thinking about Mega, and I'm thinking about Nature, too.
Nature's there, and you can't forget Capone and Nori. Capone and Nori.
Yeah, there's Nori, there's Pone, there's Cheeks, it's a lot of you. That's why I said no matter if you pick five, you're going to leave one out, you're going to leave somebody out. So, but I'll go with I would go with Trag, because Trag is like, you know, he started a lot of styles for a lot of people out here. So I would say Trag is the last one.
We were just saying, like, if I told you my top five was G-Rap, Trag, Prodigy, Cormega, and LL Cool J, that's not a crazy top five. That's not a crazy top five at all. And I didn't even name Nas. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's how ill Queen
is.
And
I was
going to
say that is a crazy top five. Yeah, because just them five alone, they out of control. You feel me? So it's kind of like any way you slice it, you could always get a mean top five from Queen. There's no question about it.
Man, there's all kinds of them. Of course, you know, there's people like Ollie Vegas that are dope.
There's mad other people.
I don't want to leave out the Godfather, man. She's Shan. I don't want to leave out Shan. That's my homie, too.
There's Cannabis. There's Super Lover C, Casanova Rudd, Roxanne Shate, Craig G. There's for days you could go on. There's Tricore Quest. We ain't even getting to that. There's Run DMC. Like, come on. You know,
but even John 50 belonged there.
Yeah, there's Gold, there's Fifth, you know, so, there's Flush, there's a lot of people out here that's fit, you know.
There's a lot of people out here that's John rolled his fucking credit, and everybody acts like Ja was just this dude that made R&B records. That ain't true at all. Ja Rule got R&B joints for his singles and shit, but Ja Rule got some shit. And this shit Eminem and 50 killed his career. That shit ain't even true. Dude had hits after that. Clap Back was a hit. New York was a hit. Then his record label disappeared. They got indicted by the feds. Yeah, I'm not saying that the beef didn't have no impact because it did, but, I mean, it's not like that beef happened and he just went away. The dude had hits. His shit was still selling. His greatest hits album made the Billboard. Yeah. Like,
I mean, I always
John deserves his credit, man. Because John has his shit.
You can't get hype off of that.
Yeah.
Come on, man. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm gonna get rolling, guys. I'm gonna get rolling. I gotta go take care of something. But I want to thank you guys again. And Mike Geronimo, man, I truly mean that it's an honor to talk to you, man. You're a Hall of Famer in my book,
bro.
And I salute you, man. And I hope you can come back on one day, and I can get a full interview with you, man. Because like I'm a genuine fan of yours, and
I appreciate it.
I have to go.
As long as y'all have me, I'll be back. Thank you,
man. You're welcome anytime. But I definitely salute you, and I truly mean it when I say I'm a fan, and I consider you a Hall of Famer in my book, and many other people's books as well. So I salute you, and I mean that. And I'm going to go ahead and turn the interview over to my co-host, and I appreciate everybody on the line, man. Y'all be good.
I appreciate it. Thank you, bro. Real talk. Thank you so much, man.
Peace out, Jeff.
I mean, like Geronimo, like he was saying, man, I mean, the fact is QB, well, Queens in general, I don't think Queens has always really gotten the respect that they deserve, that y'all deserve in terms of what you all brought, because especially in the 90s, when we look at the West Coast really be coming up, we still got to look at what was happening in Queens during that time, you know, Main Source, you know, Large Professor, you know, Breaking Adams. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this was Nas's first appearance on Live at the Barbecue. A couple years later, you would do Zebrahead soundtrack with Halftime. You know, and all these artists were all in the mix of this. Tragedy Gaddafi would drop his joint, Tragedy, you know, Saga of Intelligent Hoodlum in 93. You know, so this is, and then you come in 95. And then, of course, a couple of years later, because how could I be remiss to not mention Flush? Because, I mean, when we first heard Ice Down Medallions, oh, my God.
And everybody finds
it. Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, he was a teacher featured prominently on your album, and it's like, you know, when we look at that era of it, New York, it was, the air was just different. The music was different. It was just a whole vibe in terms of just that East Coast. I mean, you know, you're thinking about, you know, St. John's, Felipe Lopez, Biggie's Basketball.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're taking me back, real talk.
You know, I mean, you know, the essence of New York City. Pretty much in terms of you were around so many distinguished alumni, which you eventually became part of that pantheon of legends. What was it like in terms of really getting into the game, in terms of what was your first forays into rap, and in terms of really getting down, you know, getting to writing, understanding how to count your bars, you know, really rhyming over, you know, keeping the rhythm, you know, your cadence on tracks. Take us through that journey of the beginning, you know, to what is still being continued on today.
It was some of it I would, for lack of a better way of putting it, I was just completely oblivious to, naive to, because I started off as a DJ. So,
okay,
you know, I had like Technique 1200s and Gem Sound speakers and Gemini mixer and all of that. So I didn't even know how to structure a song. You know, like, it was really large and being around him. And then afterward, meeting Irv, and Irv Gotti showing me, you know, the structure of how to write a song. I didn't know any of that. You know, I just started off rhyming at Large Crib, and he would just, you know, play beats from the SP, or he would just cut records off, and we would just be in his living room just spitting, you know. So I knew how to freestyle, but I think it was just more so, it was inadvertent, because it was just something I was doing. But the more I did it, the more I got the hang of just freestyling and just spitting off top. And then, you know, when I met Irv, Irv was the one who was explaining to me, like, yo, these are bars. And, you know, you're usually going to write 16 bars, and then you're going to come in with the hook. And when you write your song, you want your hook to come first. And so a lot of it I kind of was oblivious to, because I wasn't one of them MCs that, you know, started as an MC. So some of it I had to learn. But then once I learned it, I kind of got the hang of it, and it just went from there, you know. And I think my biggest obstacle was trying to become familiar with how you write an actual song, as opposed to just trying to write a bunch of bars because you're ready to battle whoever comes in front. So I had to learn how to adjust to that. But, and then the rest of it was just mostly what you felt, you know. So that's really how it all started for me. And then I just took it from there and ran with it, bro.
One thing about it, when you're looking at the... Go ahead, King. Go ahead.
I was saying one of the keys, too, especially coming out around that time period where you had all that type of talent, was finding a way to stand out in the midst of those people. Because, man, it was like that 90s rap scene, as well the R&B scene, that was like a straight up apex what going on with black culture. So you was able to stand out. That's what's so impressive about you. You had the voice that stood out. Your style of production was different from what a lot of people was using at the time. So that was one of the main issues that a lot of artists had, was standing out, because, man, that competition was thick.
Oh, yeah, it was competition-wise, it was definitely, well, you know, if I think about it, it kind of might be that way for the younger dudes now, because there's such an oversaturation or a saturation of rappers now. But it was kind of the same in that sense where, yeah, you had 1,000 people doing the same thing. I don't know with me that I actually ever cognizantly sat there and was like, yeah, okay, I'm going to do this to stand out. I didn't. I just I was just me. And if that worked and if that made me something that you didn't always see, then it was cool. If it didn't, I wouldn't have known because I didn't know how to do anything other than just be me. You know, so thankfully all of that resonated and it worked out, you know, but I think that actually comes from being from Queens and being from, you know, that era and that style and that way, because all we knew how to do was tell our story. And all we knew how to do was tell our story in a rhythm or in a cadence that it was all our own, you know, and other boroughs didn't sound the way we sounded. So we just would take that and just run with it, you know?
Now, Mike, this show we're having right here is something historical because you are part of, I have to get myself together because I want to make sure that I put this in proper context. There are golden years, and then there are years of just tremendous achievement of which you were a part of. There is, and I'm going to use a sports analogy with this. The 2001 Miami Hurricanes had 17 players drafted in the first round in the NFL. I think if not the whole, I think, and when we look at 1995, King and myself were talking about this the other day. 1995, arguably, is probably the greatest year ever in hip-hop in terms of releases. Once again, here's a short list of the albums that came out that year, yours included. Cuban Links, August 1st, 1995. I believe Faith's album came out in August 95. Dog Pound Dog Food comes out in 1995.
Oh, that was a good one.
One of your very good friends, and we're going to get into this later on because you developed a real bond with him, Tupac's Me Against the World, 1995.
Yeah.
I mean, the show soundtrack, 1995. Groove Theory's album, 1995. Movies. We haven't even gotten into the movies yet.
You making me want to go listen to the Groove Theory shit when I get off the phone with y'all. Like, word, Groove Theory shit was hot, right? I remember Groove Theory.
We haven't even got to the movies. Casino and Heat came out in 1995. I mean, you were part of. I mean, dude, what a time to be alive.
it was crazy.
It was organic.
Yes.
The sales was a reflection of the consumer and the fan base. So that means they had to physically drive to the store, rain, sleet, or snow, and thunderstorm to buy your product. That's a testament of your staying power how to legitimize and stand in the game.
I can't forget Frost. Shout out to LA, the OG Frost, Kid Frost legend. Smile Now, Die Later. That came out in 1995, and of course, Jizzah's Liquid Swords came out in 1995. I mean, oh my God! I mean, this was just
I don't want to say a renaissance because a renaissance would imply that it happened before and it didn't. It was just, I mean, and that's not even counting, like, that was like the middle of the Nirvana wave, and that was like, I mean, the 90s in itself, it was just so much of a, it was so much of a shift.
And the Infamous came out in 95.
Yeah, so it was just so much energy in the mid and early 90s that, you know, you just had somebody new every 2 seconds, and they were phenomenal, and they had something to say, and it stuck with people. And I just think what was happening at that time culturally and economically and all these other facets of what makes us, it was just a very radical period of time, and it was a lot of changes, but they all came at one time, and it was just dope to be a part of. I wouldn't replace it for anything in the world.
Definitely. So when you meet Chris and Irv Gotti, and y'all pretty much are developing, you know, y'all are really developing everything. Take us through that process of what would ultimately, you know, you end up signing. Because, and correct me if I'm wrong on the editor's check, I believe you were the first rapper signed to TVT ever.
Yeah.
You know,
correct.
So take us.
I mean,
so
it was
what
cool.
was the pro? Take us through that process of how y'all eventually secured that deal.
Irv and I had been, you know, Irv had me in the studio, and you know, at first I was kind of reluctant to do it. I don't know why I had a reluctance, but he's like, you know, just come try it, and if you don't like it, you don't have to do it again, and blah, 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 and such, such. So I went in the studio, and we actually, the first song I ever recorded, like, in life in a studio was Shit's Real. And so we had did Shit's Real, and I did, I think we did maybe four or five more songs. You know, Irv would come back and tell me, you know, labels were talking, da-da-da-da-da. And then we had actually shot the video for Shit's Real before we even signed the deal. And it was Hype Williams that shot the video. Shout out to Hype. So, and this was actually like, it was the first video, I think, aside from K7, that Hype had shot a video for. And
yeah,
Hype
when they did
was getting
Come,
ready to his,
that was all clean.
Right.
Clean
and
1994.
Exactly. So this was like the second to third video that Hype had shot. And, you know, and everything started coming together. But then, you know, Irv was just like, yo, this shit ain't moving fast enough. Like, yo, we should just press the shit up on our own. And I was just like, how are we going to do that? And he's like, I don't know, but I'm going to figure it out. And he did. You know, and then once he did, Chris had a lot to do with, you know, helping us get what we needed to press the records up and distributing the record on our own. And, you know, from there, like, we really grinded. Like, Irv would sleep in front of radio stations in his van. And so, you know, he saw DJs coming in to go on, you know, their morning program or whatever shift it was. We would go to every single nightclub, and, you know, we would give every DJ the 12-inch record, and I would just be like, yo, if you like it, rep it. If you don't, break it over your knee. And you don't got to be bothered, you know. And thank God it all resonated. And it was, to look back at it now, I think that because I was a teenager and, like I said, I was oblivious to most things. I was just, you know, like, going through the motions of life. Like, it didn't to me seem like it was hard work. It didn't to me seem like we were doing anything that, like, you wouldn't do if you wanted to get somewhere and you wanted to get something done. It just seemed like natural. It just seemed like the natural course of what to do. And we did that, you know. But again, like I said, it's to look back now and to understand what it all became and to understand what music was and what it is and what it's becoming, like, yeah, we paid our dues, you know, and we knocked on a lot of doors and we stayed up a lot of hours and we put a whole lot of energy into, you know, we got to get to the next stop. We got to get to where this takes us. And that's cool to be able to sit back and to reflect on. And, you know, you feel that alone makes you feel accomplished, because it's not easy, you know, to stay up at 4 in the morning and sleep in front of radio stations and hope somebody plays your record. You know, and it's not
easy
to, it's not easy to go to every nightclub and confront people you don't know. And, you know, say it with your chest out. You don't know these folk. You're just hoping that they like what you give them. And we did all of that, and we did it without blinking. And I'm grateful that we did. You know, and like I said, it's awesome to be a part of a plan that people sat down and said, here's the plan, and we're going to change our lives, and if we do this, then watch and see. And that's what happened. You know, so I'm honored. I'm thankful.
And you know what was dope back then, too, was the people that were considered the gatekeepers at the time, they had enough knowledge in the way anytime they involved new talent, it became a pivotal moment. Just like when you was on mm-hmm. Stretch and Bobito, one of the greatest hip-hop mm-hmm. shows ever made.
Yes, sir. Shout out to Stretch Airball. That's family forever. Yeah, but like exactly like those moments, like it's funny because I can go on YouTube now with my kids and I can play a freestyle that I did with Stretch and Bobito. And the way they hear it, they just hear their dad making music. The way I hear it is, like, I'll say to myself, wow, I would have never imagined that night us just having fun on that college radio station would eventually become, you know, part of the fabric of something that's curated and something that's culturally a part of the world. You know, we didn't know that. We were just kids involved in the music we loved. And I was just lucky enough to be around people that I genuinely vibed with. And it's the same thing, you know, there's a video with, like, I think it's me, X, and Mos Def, and Pun, and we're all freestyling at a restaurant, and we never knew that these things would become what they are to the fabric of hip-hop. We just did what we love doing. And so that makes it all way more, you know, special. We just have so much honor and special, yeah. And it's cool because you didn't know that this is where it was heading. So like I said, to look at it now and to say, yeah, I can actually see the part I played, the part we played, the part we made, the part we added to. It's dope, and no one could ever take it from you. So it's amazing. It's amazing.
And one thing about it too, Mike, and was when you look at it, and I read an interview a while back. This was years ago, of course. Mm-hmm. Irv talked about it that when y'all shot the video, he always joked about how there were just no permits and y'all just shot every fucking way.
Oh, yeah. There was a whole lot of, yo, put those away. Yo, we got to go. Yeah, it was a lot of that happening.
Just the freedom of it. Like, yo, we just got to go and just shoot this way. So it was just like guerrilla warfare. Like, But what you said echoed the sentiments of it because, and man, we still got so much to get to, but wow, we're loving this. When you look at the time back then, I don't think a lot of the young heads today really understand what it was in terms of really having to market. Now we have social media. We have IG. Thank God for it because we get to talk to legends like yourself because of it. Social media has really... Yeah. It's like Event Horizon, for those of my science fiction horror nuts, about how the ship basically, technology in the ship.
That's the perfect analogy for it.
Y'all got to watch the movie. For those that haven't seen Event Horizon,
you got to watch the movie to really get it.
But basically it facilitates a more efficient means of communication in terms of product placement and dissemination. Back in the day, you know, you really had to be out there. You know, you had to press up copies. You had to get out there.
You had to earn it.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, you had a DJ Clue, Ron G, you know, all of them back in the day, you know, who were the mixtape, you know, it's Kay Slay, can't forget the legendary Drama King, you know, and that's
Shout
how
out.
You were getting, yeah. yeah, you were getting your name out there. I think one thing about it, too, take us, because you said Shit's Real was the first song you did. Now, I mean, you used Denise Williams' Free Sample, and oh my God, I think the song was universally loved to begin with, so you put a hip-hop spin on it, just bringing MC into it, which really just, oh God, I mean, like I said, the song hit.
It's so weird, bro, because I can never hear, if I hear the beginning of that record, like the original, like if someone plays Free and I hear it drop and I just hear this, it feels like now it's part of my own existence. So it's almost like I can't hear her record and not think about my own life. And I must have heard that song a million times growing up, and I never would have imagined that it would be so much of a part of my own existence. So shout out.
Definitely. Kind of like when those people hear Carl Thomas, I Wish, and then they think about Jay-Z's Give It To Me, and then they think, I wish I never
heard.
And it's intertwined.
Right. It's intertwined, and you'll never, like, I'll never not hear Free and not remember how my career started. Like, it just triggers me to go back to, you know, me and Irv having nothing, me, him, and Ja running around, and Chris Black and all that hustling we did and all of that grinding we did and all that uncertainty we had, you know.
What were the streets of New York like back then in terms of when it was just, because we know about it from the music perspective because of all the classics you all gave us. But the street stories have to be told as well, because you can't have one without the other. We had Team Supreme out there, you know, during the, what was it like with that time?
Yeah, I mean, shout out Supreme. That's pop forever, you know what I mean? Shout out Supreme. But it was a gauntlet. Like, it was a gauntlet. And sometimes you're in a time and a place, and like I said, you don't realize all the things around you that are happening because you're just there. You're just going through it, you know. But like I said, when you allow yourself to get older, God bless, you know, you to get to a point where you could look back at things and make sense of everything. It's like you realize how unpredictable and how crazy and how dismal and how violent and fast and there was just all these things happening in New York at that time, you know, and it was just very hectic, and it was very you just couldn't call it. You could call it, like, it's funny because my brother and me were talking the other day, and we were talking about, you know, we were talking about if New York is worse now than it was when we were kids. And I said, yo, it's like the first time that I ever really had to sit there and ask myself that question, like, is it as bad now as it was, or is it worse now than it was when we were kids? And my brother was like, nah, bro, you got to remember, like, we were losing people every other day. We were, you know, we was outside. We was into some things that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have been involved in. We were doing things that maybe, you know, we didn't necessarily have to be a part of, you know, but it was just so much going on at that time, and it was just so hectic, and it was just so uncertain that a lot of that is what led me to Righteous. With, you know, when I was that age, and I wasn't, you know, I don't want to be perceived as being, like, knee-deep in a bunch of shit that I shouldn't have been in, but, you know, I had my share of things I was involved in, and, you know, at that age, at that time, you just didn't know if you was going to see next week. You didn't know if you was going to see next month. You damn sure wasn't thinking about 5 years from now. You know, you were thinking about the here and now. And So I really will shit's real because I was just like, yo, if anything does happen, I don't want to just be another dude that was out here that didn't leave a mark in the world. You know, and that's what led me to write Another Day Stepping to the Belly of the Beast and all of that. You know, and that's what that came from. So that time period in New York was very, like I said, it was a gauntlet, but thank God we found something that pulled us away from all of those things and gave us an opportunity to have, you know, different outcomes. And so that's about what it was, bro.
Definitely, and on the block, it was all about, you know, you had to deal with the bullies, billies, and buck 50s, and not in that order.
And the Giuliani era.
Exactly. So, like, you know, we came up in the era of, you know, crack, and we came up in the era of, you know, Tech Nines and Mac 11s, and you know, you go to school and people would have 380s in their books. They would cut the pages out the books and put the hammer in the book and tape it, you know. So that's just shit we knew growing up. It was, people would have razor blades under their tongue, you know, like this. Man. Was just the environment that we were a part of, you know. And like I said, when you're in it, and especially when you're in it and you're young, you're not really understanding fully what all of this is. You're just going with it, you know. So it was tough. It was tough. But I think that because it was so tough, that came out in the music. And I think that because it was so much of a gauntlet, that's what made Wu-Tang, and that's what made a Notorious B.I.G., and that's what made a Tupac, and that's what made, you know, a Nas or anyone that you could think of in that era, DMX, what have you. It was that hunger and that being up against the clock and that not knowing what hand the clock was on. All of that shit made us, it compelled us, it drove us. It instructed us, it influenced us, so that came out in the music, you know. So was it unfortunate? Was it anything that you'd want your kids to go through or be a part of? No, but as I said, if you give time, I always say that time is the only thing in the world that lies to nobody, you know. So if you give anything enough time, you'll get to see the full picture. And out of all of those things that were maybe not too appetizing, you know, if you didn't have those things, you wouldn't have the power behind the music that you did. And you wouldn't have the sincerity that you had behind that music. And you wouldn't have the intricacy and description that you were getting from MCs at that time, because all those negative things compelled us to be the way we were as artists.
Wow. I mean,
man, to quote Nature, because you said something real deep about time. He said, the foulest thing about time, it ticks even when you're gone.
Yeah, correct.
Life goes on.
Correct.
Yeah, life goes on.
It don't lie to you. You know what I mean? Like, time might not tell you the full story, but you can never say it lied to you when it tells you the whole story. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes. Oh, that's deep. Wow.
Hey, we drop gems on Off the Cuff Radio, man. We got Mike Geronimo in the building, man. You know you're going to get some knowledge.
Yes.
You're going to get some culture knowledge. You're going to get all types of good game here. That's what we do here.
Man.
Yeah. That's the only way we do it, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, Geronimo, so the song takes off. What is it like for you all when you realize you all have a hit on your hands?
I was like, holy shit. I think Irv handled it way better than I did, because, you know, like, with Irv, it was different because I think Irv was always prepared for anything that arose. So Mm-hmm. Anything that came, he was like, yeah, that worked out just the way I wanted. Or he would be like, all right, cool. So he took it all in stride. Me, on the other hand, I was more like, I was in like bubblehead mode, bro, because I was kind of like I said, I wasn't saying to myself, yo, when I grow up, I want to be a rapper and I want to do that. That's not at all what I was doing. So I just did everything, and then it started to pop, and I was just like, okay, cool. So I guess I'm not going to college now. you know, and then it just started, it got bigger from there. And then I think the hardest part for me was I didn't realize what you trade off becoming an artist. So I think the hard part for me was like, yeah, people are going to look at you, and people are going to want to come up to talk to you, and people are going to want to, you know, just be around every 2 seconds, and, you know, your life isn't just yours anymore. And so those were the things that were kind of hard for me to adjust to, and I just wasn't ever really comfortable with, like, the spotlight, which is weird because it's kind of like, all right, you're an artist, so you should know you're going to be in the spotlight. But I didn't think about it in that way. I just thought, like, all right, I know how to do this, and there's a studio, and everyone tells me I sound good doing it, so let me just see what happens. And, you know, and it happened, and it was a mixed bag for me. You know, like, it had its upside where, you know, like, I remember my mom hearing, you know, the record for the first time on the radio, and I remember, you know, the video coming on and all my friends bugging out, my little brother and my cousins and them wilding out, and, you know, all those good things. And then I remember the things where I was like, okay, so now we got to move different, you know. So it was a mixed bag, but it just all happened really fast. And we didn't have a choice. It was either, you know, you hold on to this horse as fast as it's galloping so you don't fall off of it, or, you know, you just opt to let go of the reins. And we weren't going to let go of the reins, so we just rode.
Now, when you got the deal with TVT, Mike, was that a situation where the time was a singles deal and a transition to an album deal, or was it an album deal from jump and then you got the single out first?
Yeah. It was an album deal definitely from jump. Like, it was actually,
okay.
I think they actually wanted me to do more albums than I ended up signing to contractually do.
Because we're going to get to that too, when we dropped Vendetta in 97. We're going to get to that.
Right. So when I first signed with TVT, I pretty much signed a standard 3-album deal. And it was of a bidding war between TVT and 2 other labels. And, you know, we sat down with Steve Gottlieb, and I felt good. You know, after the first time I met him and we talked, and Irv felt like it was the best opportunity for us because they were a brand new hip-hop label, and because it would mean I was like the first rap artist they had ever signed. So he kind of was looking at it like, you know, for you it's kind of an insurance policy because you're the first one they ever signed, and because of that, you know, there's always going to be things they do for you they would never do for anyone else.
Like
the trade-off for that. Exactly. You know, but the trade-off for that is, you know, if you're the first, then all the good things that they do, you feel, and all the bad things that they do because they don't know, because this is everyone's first time, you take those hits too. So it's kind of like everything is a trade-off, you know, but it felt good. It felt like where we were supposed to be. And, you know, for all intents, like, it became home, you know, and my life, whether it exists or not, it will always be my home, you know. So shout out to TVT, shout out to Steve, Vera, everybody, Wanda, Brian Lee, Patricia, everyone that was here.
Now, one thing about it is when an album comes in, because there's so many different nuances in terms of going through the process of signing deals, especially back then. So many guests mm-hmm. we've talked to have talked about the how negotiations go, and then when it's actually album time. Obviously, you know, it was TVT Blunt Recordings, so this is a joint venture. Mm-hmm. When you look at that time in terms of it, because we're about, you know, once again, y'all, this album is monumental because I'm about to drop the trivia on y'all in a minute. But the thing is, what was it like in terms of securing those features? Because also, too, for those that don't know, the group The Murderers, Ja Rule, DMX, and Jay-Z, Time to Build was the first song that they were all on. We're going to get mm-hmm. to that later as to what happened in terms of, you know, why the group didn't necessarily, you know, because Irv said, and I guess I'm getting ahead of myself, I'm trying to get back, because Irv said he always hated the fact that they never did an album together, mm-hmm. that they could just mm-hmm. never get it together. But your album was the first that all of them would do it. And then they would come together mm-hmm. on Murdergram again for Streets is Watching soundtrack in 1998. But you also, right. like Pat said, you had Royal Flush prominently featured on this. You had, you know, the Lost mm-hmm. Boys on the, you know, Mass I.C. remix. So mm-hmm. it's like you had like a Murderer's Row of dopeness coming out. What was it like getting all of this together in terms of when it was actually time to go in and do a full record?
It wasn't hard, bro, like, or some real shit, I think. But I think with my album, the vibe was more, all right, we in. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, okay. We knew the door was open, and so to us, it was just vibing with people we always vibe with. You know, like I said, I was tight with Lost Boys, and Cheeks is like family to me. So, you know, when Harv Pierre, shout out to Harv at Bad Boy, Harv Pierre.
Joe Hooker, yeah.
Bad Boy, Joe Hooker. You know, Harv was the one who was like, yo, Cheeks needs to do this remix shit. With, like, you need to do something with LBs. And I was just like, yo, that's family, like, you know, so even the session was no different than us being at the park together. You know, we just went and did it and doing a natural, like, you know, doing songs with, like, Flush and OC or my man CeeLo or, you know, even doing Time to Build with X and Hov and Rule. You know, working with Rule would be in the studio with me every day, damn it. You know, so even when we wasn't doing my shit, they were working on Cash Money shit.
Cash Money Click, yeah.
We just, right. So we just vibed, and we had, you know, songs that we did with, we knew them by heart, and we knew how each other flowed, and we knew, you didn't have to tell us nothing. We all vibed. So I think with my project, it was just vibes. It was just a bunch of people that always fuck with each other, just bringing that energy into the studio. You know, and were there things like, you know, I think the only exception to that was Time to Build. But even on that note, even with Irv saying, yo, I have this idea for this song and I'm going to use it so that we could introduce this one and this one and this one. And even if that was a part of the Method of the Madness, it still was a vibe. You understand what I'm saying? So we still all attacked it like, all right, I'm spitting with my men. You know, like, yeah, hold your, all right, that's my nigga, let's do it. Or actually, that's my nigga, let's rock. Or, so we all had a vibe, and we just brought that energy to the project. So in my opinion, the way I see it, the way it was for me, from my vantage point, none of it was hard for us to do because we were just all people that all vibed and spit and saw things the same way. And it didn't take anything for us to be like, yo, we going in a lab and we going to do this. We would just go and do it. You know, and a lot of the natural was very spontaneous. It was very organic. It was just moments of, we might just happen to be in a lab and we might have knocked one song out, but we just felt so good, we end up doing another one, and now you got, you know, three stories high, or Everything Must Change, or The Natural.
Oh,
it was just mostly vibe. So
Everything Must Change was just so soulful, man.
Shout out to Mark Sparks.
Cool.
Like, and and we didn't even think of that song. Like, I think the day I did Everything Must Change, I did Shireen. And I think I just wrote Shireen, like, right there. And we just felt so good, and I just started playing the keys on the keyboard. And the next thing I know, we ended up doing Everything Must Change. So it was just an organic magic about it, and it wasn't hard to get everybody to get together to do what they do, because it's what we all love doing, and that came out, you know?
Yeah, and okay, so now you have a hit album. I mean, so you first go from a hit song to a hit album. So what is it like when you see that, when the album becomes a hit?
It was weird. It was weird to me because, like I said, it wasn't, you know, like I said, it's a lot different when you have an intent and you know where you want to end up. And for me, I didn't have an initial intent. So I always was just like, yo, if one person bought it or if a million people bought it, it didn't really matter to me. I just wanted to know that I did something in life that, you know, most people don't get to do. So when it did start taking off, it caught me by surprise, to be honest. It caught me by surprise. Like, I can't say that I didn't think that we didn't have a good album. Like, I would listen to it, and I would just have this feeling that whatever we were doing, like, just keep going. I would just tell myself, just keep going. Like, you're on to something. I didn't know what I was on to. I didn't know how big or small it was. I just knew that feeling that you have, you know. And so when it did start to take, when it did start to catch on, it felt good. You know, it felt good. You know, it felt fulfilling. You know, and it made me happy because people around me was that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, it was a vibe where you guys were hungry, you guys was coming in with determination to get on. It was before, you know, the politics and the business came across. You know what I mean?
Fact. Yeah, fact. You know, like, we didn't know that side of it. You know, especially, like, you know, me and Flush, like, you know, Irv was the one who was, you know, pretty much channeling the business moves and the Chris. So we didn't know the politicking and the you know, the industry shit. We just knew, yo, we from Flushing and we did this, and this is how we rock, and the world gets to see it, and niggas like it, and that's good enough for me. You know? So like I said, it was all very fulfilling, and it just all happened very fast.
And it's crazy because, Mike, when that album, this album probably on the low, for those that really know, has some of the best production from a lot of the, I mean, dude, you had a Jay-Z before we know him now as Jay-Z in terms of what you, I mean, you have the Beat Miners, you know, working with Black Moon. Of course, you have Nasheen Myrick, who was part of Puffy's Hitman Squad. You have Buck Wild.
Yeah, the Hitman,
I mean, dude, this is like a who. Your album is like a who's list of legends, rapping and producing. This is like Illegal's The Untold Truth record with Eric Sermon and Laura Finesse on it. This is like, you know what I'm saying, Nas's Illmatic. This is like, I'm going through all of this, thinking about some of the greatest debuts in hip hop history, in terms of who was on it, and your album is in that conversation. This is a milestone moment in terms of it, because this record, I think The Natural was simply that, organic. It was original. It was something that just flowed. And this is before the pomp and circumstance, because hip hop in the 90s, we were beginning to start seeing the, probably around 96, 97 is when we really started seeing the ostentatiousness. This is when we started seeing the Bentleys, you know, the chains.
Right. Yeah.
We knew everything was good for you, because we remember that chain that you rocked on the second album. The Cuban with that Mike Geronimo piece. We're like, yeah, son, you're good. look, Mike, you had Joy, Nas had that big ass QB piece. We were like, yo.
Yeah, it was all right. It was all right.
Yeah, man. So what did you learn about the business as you were going along? Because like you said, Herb was handling a lot of it. What did you all learn along the way in terms of how it began to operate once you all had both feet in and were really really wading through? Because obviously now, you know, you're major in it. You're meeting people, you know, you're really interacting with a lot of heavyweights in the industry. So you're you're major now. What is that? How was that transition in terms of you adjusting in terms of really like, okay, like this is really my job now, and this is really like different?
A mixed bag again, you know, because I think a point came where I started to realize, like, okay, yeah, it's fun to do and it started out as fun, but, you know, you're starting to realize that, you know, okay, there's a lot of money generated and there's a lot that goes behind ensuring that, you know, a profit's made and there's, you know, that it's work, you know, and you get hit with the realization that, you know, it is work, and it, for as much fun as it is, it's also a job, and and it's a job that doesn't, it's not like, you know, it's not a 9-to-5. It's not like you go home and you get a couple of hours where this isn't what you think of and it isn't what you worry about. It isn't what you, it's every hour of every day. And it's like, you're this, that's what it is. It's just, you're an artist and you're signed, and there's never a point when you're not an artist and you're not signed, you know, and that has its, how do I put it? That could be a downer for lack of a better way of saying it, because you kind of realize, like, it's not just about you having fun. But then, you know, then there's the other side of it where because of that, it's like, okay, that actually works to keep you competitive. And it works to make you start to say, well, you know, if you like where you're sitting, you better make sure you stay here. So you should go right. You know what I mean? Or, you know, so it drives you, it compels you to keep being at a certain standard. And I think the other part of it is I started to realize, like, okay, there's going to be people that want to come in the kitchen and kind of suggest what ingredients you need when you're cooking your stew. You're the only cook here. Always remember that. So it's kind of like you get to like a point where you're like, okay, there's all this money being generated and there's all these new people and there's all these faces and there's all these places and there's all these things you do. And, but you got to kind of keep your eye on everything that's on the conveyor belt, and you got to kind of say to yourself, all right, I'm going to hear a lot of opinions and what to do and how to do it, and but just hold on to your recipe, you know, and you start to realize things like that. And then, you know, and then there's the part where you start to segue into other things. Like, I never thought about modeling for, like, Hill figures. Like, I would have never thought about that in my life. Like, I'd have been like, what? I'm going to do what? But, you know, that comes from it. And I end up,
hey, look,
you know,
at
getting involved in film.
He models for Polo. I mean, look how it worked out for
right.
him.
Right, right. And, you know, and so
shout out to
Thurston, now you're doing
life.
Modeling.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, shout out to Thurs, real talk. And then, you know, you end up doing film and you're doing voiceovers and, you know, you're doing all these other things that aren't rap. But because you rap, it's an opportunity right there. And so it's a lot to digest at one time. And I think I had those moments where it was incredibly overwhelming to me, where it gave me a lot of anxiety. But then I would have those moments, right, but then I would have moments where I was like, okay, well, this is what it is, so what do you want to do with it? You know, so you kind of, like I said, you get hit with the realities of it, but it's all about what you decide to do once you get hit with the realities that come from, you know, having a bit of success so fast, so early.
You know, one thing about it, Mike, when we look at this, because we have to reference the interview you did with Drink Champs, which was absolutely unbelievable. It was incredible because you were so candid about your time in terms of everything you had dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the situations today, because we see so many, you know, young niggas trying to get in the game who want to be famous, mm-hmm. who want this viral, who want to be a viral sensation, but a lot of times do not understand the responsibility of what it takes. It's like having a gun with no safety and you're going to shoot yourself in the foot doing the wrong thing on, you know, online.
Correct.
And,
yeah.
And for the 90s, we know it was wild in terms of what was going on. Because like I said, this is really when we start seeing the money, you know, going back to like 95, 96. Mm-hmm. And I mean, God knows, I mean,
yeah.
the Cash Money came in 98. It just totally tore the roof off. I mean, the bling bling
yeah,
album
absolutely.
Full effect out
yeah.
there.
Yeah,
so, it was crazy.
So now we're comparing eras at the time because the money was just beginning to come then. And now the money is in full swing now. The difference is there was an understanding of where you all came from, the experiences that molded you as men, shaped you in your character, and guided you in the direction of how you were taught about why you weren't prepared for everything. You had an idea of what was coming because of what the foundation had already been set from previous experiences. Well, what we're seeing now mm-hmm. with that, today we're seeing a lot of young people out there that really they have no direction at all in terms of what they're doing with it. And this is not to down mm-hmm. the younger generation of hip-hop because we love all the generation. We're not the angry
right.
men screaming at the sky, but we're just seeing
right.
the difference in terms of approaches. We're seeing the difference in how they handle conflicts. We're seeing,
mm-hmm.
because certain things, I mean, y'all were really from the streets. So you knew back
yeah.
in the day if some shit really got out of hand, what could really happen if you said somebody's name on a track. And, you know, that wasn't nothing to play with back then.
Right.
You know, and now everybody thinks they're going to name call somebody out there on an album and like, yeah, like, fuck that nigga. Yeah, I dare him do something.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but you saw what happened to a few rappers that got out there talking crazy, whether on Twitter or in videos, and throw shade, but I mean, Lil Jojo, when he hollered at Chief Keef about trying to, you know, step up to them, and then 3 hours later, he gets whacked, and then the situation with FBG Duck, He did that video, Dead
right.
Bitches, and then he was, yeah, I mean, it's like y'all had an understanding of the energy that could be put out at certain levels, and I think that's why the conflicts had to be really, really serious for you all to go there, where now there's just like a anything goes to however I can get famous. When you look at your time in industry now, then, Geronimo, what you're seeing now, how do you see the changes?
I think for myself, bro, and I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for the whole world, but I just try to keep it in a perspective, you know, and it's funny because half of me says, I remember when we came in, and I remember the people from the generation ahead of us, some of them were upset with us. Like, I remember, I'm not going to say who it was, but it was a rapper I grew up listening to, and I remember we was in some event one night, and he said, you know, he introduced himself, and I was just honored to meet him. And, you know, one thing led to another, and he asked me, he said, you know, I like y'all, what y'all do, but y'all fucking it up now. Like, why y'all only talk about drugs and guns and money? And, you know, we're kids at the time. We're 18 years old. We don't know our asses from our elbows. We just think we do. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so my response was, well, that's what we see. You know, and it was just a very candid response. It was like, that's what we see. That's what we know. And so I keep that side of me where I say to myself, you can't be upset at these kids for doing and seeing what they know. That's what it is now. Is it unfortunate that now things are more gang-oriented? Yes. Is it unfortunate that now things are more about an instant gratification, and there's this focus on materialism, and everything is, you know, look at my life, look at my likes, look at my followers, look at me. Yeah, all of this shit is, you know, it's a little perplexing, you know, but I think, like I said, I know what me. One of the things that makes me the happiest about life now is being able to say to myself, you know what, one of the best things you ever did was to step back and allow yourself to grow and allow yourself to live and allow yourself to get to your next trip around the sun. And you started to appreciate the fact that you have the gift of being allowed to make a trip around the sun. You know, and after me personally, when I stepped away from everything and I gave myself an opportunity to be like, yo, all of us are fucking lucky to wake up tomorrow. All of us, no matter what our situation is. And so, you know, I say that as to say that I think that if these kids allow themselves to get to a stage where they start asking themselves, would it be so bad to let me grow, then they'll be all right. You understand what I'm saying? There's a lot in front of them now that doesn't give them the chance to think that way. Some of it is self-inflicted and some of it is unintended consequences, and some of it is deliberate consequences, but that's the bag of what they have to deal with, you know. And would I like to see them have more love for themselves? Hell yeah. Would I like to see them think more about, you know, 10 moves as opposed to 3, yeah. You know, but I don't give up hope on them, and I don't condemn them, because if we waste time condemning them, then we're only pushing them away, and they're only going to not want to hear us more. and they're only going to say to themselves, now, fuck that. I'm going to do what I do. Let me take the lead on my shit. You feel me? And I think
Go ahead.
Generation, we was the last to have, you know, we had OGs around. Like, I had a friend that would tell me right from wrong, or wouldn't allow me to go down a certain path because they saw something in me. I had, you know, other OGs around me that, you know, they were like, nah, don't do this or nah. You know, we had that. We were lucky enough to have that last generation of people that were in the street that went through things, but they cared enough to double back to be like, all right, I might have went through X, Y, or Z, but so you don't have to go that way or go through it. Let me show you this. You know, so there was a code, you know, and there was a respect, and there was a rationale process that you had to go through before you decided to do anything you did or decided not to. And they don't have that now, you know, and so some of it is on us, you know, some of it is on my era because, like you said, we started to see millions of dollars, and nobody told us how to move with that going on, you know what I mean? Nobody told us all those things that come with that, you know, and the people that made that possible for us, they wasn't schooling us because they looked at it like, all right, I need them to keep making this money because it's making me money. You feel what I'm saying? So some of it is on us in the sense that it was unintended. Like, it's almost as though the blind were leading the blind. You know, and where we left off, this new generation came in, and where we were seeing millions, they're seeing tens of millions. You know, like, mm-hmm. These kids now can go and do, like, they can go do 6 shows in a week, and they can literally go get a fucking a Murcielago. And it's no bullshit. It's that much money being made. You understand what I'm saying? So it's kind of like, you know, you don't give up hope. You just try to find a way. Like I said, with myself, I'm not speaking for everybody, but with myself, I try to find a way to connect with them where I'm not alienating them, and I'm actually letting them guide me through their world. And then when I see those points where I could say, all right, bro, I see you up against X, Y, and Z, that's kind of like when I was up against X, Y, and Z. The way I did it was da-da-da. You understand what I'm saying? You build from there. And that slowly starts to show them what respect is, because a lot of them really don't know what respect is. They may know what the word is, but they don't truly know what it is, because respect involves you having an actual interaction with somebody. And if all these niggas is on a smartphone, they're not really that good at interacting with people one-on-one or in an actual physical setting. They talk to each other all day on screen. You understand what I'm saying? So they're making a lot of money. They're doing less communication actually with each other as opposed to over technology or through technology. And that adds to it too. Because if I don't really see you, and if I'm not in front of you there, see your emotion and to see how you feel, not just hear you and not just read what you're saying, then how do I know how to fully react? I don't. It's a piece of the puzzle that's missing. You know, so their social base and our social base are completely night and day, and I think there's a lot they're up against. But again, with all that being said, I see glimmers of hope, and that's what's important. You know, that's what will hopefully allow them to, God be willing, 10 years from now, some of them that's talking, you know, that some of them that's on the wave they on now, you might go see them later on, and they might look back and be like, yo, I'm glad I'm not on that like that. You know, so again, everything is patience and everything is time. You just got to put the work in along with the patience and along with time.
Yeah, and I think one thing about, like you said,
still about the money problem. See, I started seeing that shift like in the mid-90s, you know, where it got to a point where these labels was just bleeding money. I'm talking about niggas was coming out, they was sneezing platinum. You know what I'm saying? So there was like so much money to be coming out. And to translate that to you releasing the Vendetta, which was your second album. Now, this ties into, did you start feeling the fun factor sort of leaving around the time you recorded that album?
Yeah, I mean, the vibe I had with doing The Natural and the vibe I had with doing Vendetta were two different things altogether. You know, I think, like I said, with The Natural, it was more of a, it was just that. It was organic. It was natural. It was just a ride. You know, and with Vendetta, it's, okay, well, now I know some of the magic tricks the magician does. You know, like, now I know how he makes a quarter disappear. And now I know how he's able to tell you to pick a card. And he can guess the card, figuratively speaking. You know, so it's kind of like, you know, the approach was more so, okay, how do I not lose being organic? And how do I not lose being a natural? But now I know what the magician does, you know, and also it was a bit of, you know, there was pressures from the labels, I think, to say, you know, well, okay, he needs to level up and we think he should be here. And so if he's here, you know, he has to do these things and X, Y, and Z. And so there was a lot of deliberate jockeying for commercial appeal. And, you know, there was also a lot of internal shit happening, you know, like, I think the working relationship with Irv was starting to kind of like slowly crack apart, you know.
Right.
Rule was right on the cusp of like really exploding as an artist. Flush was in the middle of getting ready to start his next project. Def Jam and TVT were like in this ugly legal war. And hip hop was changing.
Right.
You were starting to actually see now the, it started to become the, okay, if I got it, you have to know that I have it, and I'm going to show you we have it. And, you know, it wasn't just about, all right, let's just be on the corner rhyming. Now it was becoming, well, you have a yacht, we have a yacht too. You have a Benz, we have a Benz too. So it was all of these shifts and all of this energy being thrown around and just bouncing off the walls. And you know, and in my personal life, like, I was going through things with my relationship, and, you know, I had all the questions that artists find themselves asking about, you know, loyalty and friends and money and, you know, just all the shit that you're gonna encounter. You know,
right.
And I think Vendetta was me trying to fight through all of that and still say, all right, regardless to all of that, I'm here to make music and I'm here to make it the way I do. You know, and but along with that, you know, like I wanted to try other things, and I wanted to do other things, and I wanted to work with other people. You know, like, I wanted to work with Puff as bad as Puff wanted to work with me. And we had been talking about that for, like, you know, the better part of a year. I wanted to work with Twister. I wanted to work with Traxter from Chicago. I wanted to cast that vibe because I was a big fan of that music and that style. And, you know, I knew people in New York didn't know down south rap. They didn't know Trick Daddy. They didn't know, you know,
oh, man, you're mentioning him before. Like, he really blows. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I've known Trick for years, like him and my man Touche and everybody at Slip and Slide. I had family in Miami, and I was spending a lot of time in Miami and you know, because, like, Opa-locka and
oh, man,
and,
yeah, you beat with in a 305.
Yeah, yeah, I was in the bottom. I was down
you
in
see,
the bottom. I had folks in the bottom, you know, so I knew Zoe Pound. I knew all these things that in
Red
York,
eyes
nobody
and all those
even,
guys. Yeah,
yeah, fact. You know, like, we was going to, oh, God, not Magic City. What's the name of the shit?
Rolex?
Luke had a spot called a Rolex. Yeah. So I was in the Rolex. I was, you know, they used to let people box in the Rolex, you know, and you'd be eating wings and you in a strip club and you're like, what the fuck is this shit? But we were experiencing all of that. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, I was watching Master P and them in No Limit. I would go to Daytona Beach and you know, and I would see the No Limit bus, like, and I was hearing the I'm About It soundtrack. And so there was all these things that I was absorbing that I wanted to, you know, put my own spin on because I was fans of it, you know. And some of it I got to do, and some of it worked out, and some of it I got to do. And, you know, to be honest about it, my fan base was like, nah, I'm not ready for that shit, bro. Like, what are you doing? You understand what I'm saying? So, but Vendetta was my effort to try to get through all of that and still stay, you know, on point, on course.
When we look at that time, Mike, because a lot of people, you mentioned Trick Daddy, and a lot of people don't know that when he appeared on Luke's Scarred back in 1996, that was Trick's first record appearance. You know, rest in peace to Verb, because Verb was on that as well. And Verb,
yeah,
I believe, passed away. So this is coming a year after you drop your debut, and this is between 95 and 97 when your second album drops. But this is when Trick wouldn't really hit until he dropped Nan, and that was in 1999.
Yeah, when he dropped Nan,
even
nigga,
though
that was the first song. You ain't never lied. That was the first joint he did that took off. Nan, nigga.
Yeah, because his first, because a lot of people think about www.thug.com as his first album,
right.
But it
was
not.
Was
but based on a true story was his first album. That was in 98, and then .com came out in 99. Because when I first heard Nan, I was like, oh, my God. I was like, this, I mean, it was an undeniable hit. Shout out to Righteous Funk Boogie that did the beat. I mean, and then, you know, Trina's verse, so, you know, the versatility that in this conversation you're giving us, you know, you're showing us your versatility. Now, you and Pot, unfortunately, you know, Pot was killed. You know, what was the relationship you had with Pot? How did y'all develop that friendship along the way?
I want to say it was mostly Herb, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because we had a lot of mutual friends, and my road manager was good friends with Pop. My road manager was my man Nickel, Freddie Moore. He's actually the person that got shot in the elevator with Pop at Quad. So
November 28th, 1994, yeah.
Right. So I knew Pop because he knew a lot of the OG dudes that I knew with Queens. He would be around them. He would be with them. So initially,
right,
the first time we met, it was at, I want to say it was a Freaknik in Atlanta. And it was real brief.
He was living
by
this time,
you know, Irv. Yeah, and Irv made me hop out the MPV and give him, like, a Shish Real CD and a sticker and all of that. And he was cool, you know, he took the sticker, he dissed me, he was smoking his weed, he looked at the tape, he's like, Mike Geronimo, huh? So yeah, and he's like, all right, I'm gonna check it out. And it was cool, you know, and I didn't really think about it passed that, and then as fate would have it, like I said, he knew my man Fred, and we met, and the minute we met, we was just cool, you know, and then in particular, he had came out here one time, and we ended up in the tunnel, and there was a little incident in the tunnel. He was with us, you know, but I think the incident showed him that, you know, we was cool. We didn't, you know, we didn't care where he was, where he was from, or what he was or what he wasn't. We didn't care about that. And I just mean my immediate circle, you know, not so much the OGs that we was linked to, but I just mean the immediate niggas he seen me with, you know, when we was in the tunnel that night. We kind of, you know, we were just like, yo, you know, it's like how niggas go through something. You're like, yo, you cool nigga too. You know what I mean? And from there, whenever I was seeing him, he would show love. And then we just got cool, you know. So, again, like I said, sometimes in life things happen and they just happen so fast that you're not grasping everything going on. But, you know, when you sit back and you reflect, like, you know, it's cool to know, like, you know, like, Dan was my man. It was a pleasure meeting him. It was a pleasure being cool with him. You know, and I'm glad that that's a part of my existence. You know, so it is what it is.
When you look at the
you know, I was saying that knowing how Pac was when it came to, you know, his work ethic and, you know, bringing everybody aboard for the mm-hmm. ride. Did you guys ever talk about doing work together?
I know him and Irv definitely were talking about us recording together, and it's funny because before I met him, I wasn't really a fan of his music. So I think the only thing he did that I liked was Brenda Got a Baby.
Oh, the first album, Apocalypse Now, yeah.
Like, but other than that, I kind of was like, you know, I wasn't really, I'm pushing P on it. I wasn't really hearing, listening to him like that. But after I met him, he was dumb cool, you know, and then I remember Irv one night being like, yo, you got to do a song with Pac. And I was like, yeah, that'd be cool, you know, and then, you know, like, not too long after that, he was like, yo, y'all going to do a song together? And I was like, yo, that's cool. You know, like, whenever it happens, it does. At that point, to me, I knew me and him was cool. So, again, the same way I was saying, anybody I worked with, it was just vibe. If I vibe with you, if I fuck with you, it didn't take nothing for me to work with you. So I just looked at it like that. I was like, you know, we'll end up in the studio. If we do, we do. And when we do, it's going to be no different than being with anybody else that I bought. You know, but he was a cool dude, bro. Like, he was a cool dude. He was down to earth. And I think that's what I remember the most, you know?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we didn't get to get that Mike Geronimo Pac collaboration because especially for that era, that would have been phenomenal, especially what was going on. This, when we think about everything from years to now, from years gone by to now, this is one of the reasons why we do shows like this, because for people who are there, people we look up to, people we respect, we love, we cherish, we appreciate, you are our portal to what was going on. We were young back in the day in terms of we didn't really see everything that you saw. So we're hearing this through your lens and what you learned and observed along the way. As you continue in this game of music, because one thing you said that is so important is that you have to give yourself a chance to grow, and you have to know when the game gets a little bit too heavy, when you need to step away from it. Some people get attached to that celebrity status that they can't let it go. On Off the Cuff Radio, we don't slander or shade anybody, so we won't mention certain rappers out there right now who are fighting for relevance when their career has been colder than Alaskan salmon in 32 degree weather. You know, they're still trying to flounder around with it. And
right.
And it's like, you know, but the fact is that for some people, they can't let it go. But it's like, sometimes it is okay to just sit back and just relax. If you've made your money, count your money and live an old man life the best way in terms of retiring rightfully and not living ratchetly.
Man, these dudes don't want to become Henry Hill status. They still want to be out there in the jungles, man.
Nigga said, I ordered spaghetti and it tasted like tomato sauce.
Living the rest of their life like
egg noodles, and ketchup.
Yeah, egg noodles and ketchup. You know what? I mean, you know, man, like I said, I can't speak for the whole world. I'm not here for that. I just know what worked for me. So if you would have asked, what I did say is funny because before I started the project we're doing now, it was actually my dad who made me consider it. And I remember talking with my dad, like, right before he passed away. And my dad was funny because he knew who I was and he knew, you know, what I did. But I don't think he ever really, like, knew. You know what I mean? I don't think he ever really, absorbed it. And so, you know, he's watching YouTube and he's like, yeah, Michael, I'm watching people talking about my kid from Russia and Spain. But I didn't know the world knew my kid this way. And I was like, okay. And like, you got to get back out there, kid. You got to do it one more time. And I was like, you know, I don't know. And he's like, no, you got to promise me you get back out there. These people, they're not finished with you, kid. And so I told my dad, I said, if I ever feel that I loved it the way that I loved it, then I'll keep this promise I'm making, you know. And fast forward to now, I think one of the most amazing to me in doing this final album is that I do love it in a way that I never thought that I would. And I love it for the reasons that I always did, but I'm also loving it because I gave myself time. And because I gave myself time, I developed an appreciation for the aspects of it that I might not have paid attention to or that I might have overlooked because I never allowed myself to just stand there and look at the painting and just appreciate the painting for every little part of it that it is. And so for me, allowing myself to breathe, allowing myself to say, you know what, if you feel that you either did everything you could have, or if you feel that you couldn't possibly do it with the amount of an intensity that you've had, if that's how you feel and you need space, then it's okay for you to tell the world, I'm going to go on a walk, I'll be back. And I never really allowed myself to see it as that. I always kind of looked at it more like, if this is here and if this is where you are and if these are the walls that you're, you know, in the middle of, then you can't really move past that. And then I discovered I kind of made some of these walls for myself. You know what I mean? And so I took time away from it, and I liked a lot of what happened when I did decide to take the time away from it, you know. And I think that people need
time for experience and emotion, and I think experience and emotion play a big part in the music that you give to the world. And like I said, that might not work for everybody, but for me it does. For me it has. For me it always will. So, you know, I'm reinvigorated and I'm energetic and I'm like really having fun with knowing that I have an ability to create music. And I'm really having fun with knowing that I'm a part of this thing that's way bigger than anyone would have ever thought. And I'm having fun with being able to say, yo, I come from the same thing that LL comes from, and he comes from the same thing that Rakim comes from, and they come from the same thing that Eminem comes from, and that's the same thing that Lil Durk comes from, and you're all linked. You're all a part of this amazing thing that you all get to give to the world. And that gives you a sense of responsibility, and it gives you a sense of aspiration. And so I'm having a fucking blast doing this album. Like I'm having the most amazing time of my life musically right now, bro. You know, and I'm just thankful for that. And I say all of that is to say, like, you know, do you have to know when it's time to leave the stage? Absolutely. I think it was James Brown who said that. Like, you got to know when it's time to leave, you know.
And right.
I think when the game is over with you as an artist, or when you've done, you know, you know. You just know. You feel it. You know it. But, you know, for me, when I feel that way, I won't fight it. I don't fight it. You know, and like I said, my intent now is just to close the book in the way that I always wanted to, which is what this album I'm doing now represents. And with that, I'll know when it's time to leave the stage. You know what I mean? Like, you will not have to worry about me or say, oh, look at Mike. That nigga crazy. You should know better. Nah. Nah, bro. You know what I mean? Like not with me, it won't ever be that. With me, it's going to be, yo, what? That nigga got on a horse and rode off? What? That's my nigga. That's what's up. You know, so, and I'm cool with that. I'm cool with that.
Hey, y'all, now, before we about to wrap this thing up, I got to shoot one more question to you, man. And I got to know, what was it like recording Usual Suspects, one of the dopest posse cuts I ever heard? Because y'all had everybody on that shit. Y'all had
Locks. I have the single.
Or Mega.
Yeah.
Fatal Hussein, rest in peace. DMX, rest in peace.
Yeah.
How did you get all that
together?
That
was crazy. Again, like I said, doing all these things and bringing all these people together, it was never hard because it was always a vibe. You know,
right.
And it was always, you know, it was always a brotherhood. It was always a, all right, yeah, let's do it. You know, so it wasn't hard to get all the people that we got, you know, down to Fatal Hussein, rest in peace, down to Trads, down to LOX, you know, to Rule, to X. It was just, it was what we did, you know, and there was just a circle of us that we all respected each other. We were all fans of each other. We were all a brotherhood. We were all brothers to each other. So for us, we would just look at those, and we were all competitive. You know, and don't get it fucked up. Like, niggas was like, yeah, this is a great opportunity for me to smoke my friends on wax. You know what I mean? So, the Locks was going to take everybody's heads off. DMX was going to take your head off. You know, I the way I do it, I was going to lay my thing down, like, rule the same way. So it was just the fun of being a part of all of that. So to pull it all together, it was amazing. You know, it was intense. It was, you know, you knew you was, what's the shit, what's the movie, Gladiator, when they're in Rome and they're in the Colosseum, you was in the Colosseum. You know what I mean? So once you were in the Colosseum, they go, all right, where's my spear, where's my shield, what's up? And that's how we all went at it, you know, and it's an amazing thing to have as a memory, you know, and it's an amazing moment to again, like, I'll be grateful, bro, because I've had some amazing moments, you know, and I didn't have to have them. So for me, like, nigga, shit, I've had unreal moments, bro, and that's amazing, and that's cool, and that was one.
One thing about it is while you may have not had to have amazing moments, you did. And we're all the more richer because those moments you share with us along the way, and for the memories you gave us from those moments, we can never thank you enough for it. Geronimo, this has been an incredible interview. Thank you so much.
Oh, I've had a blast. Nah, man, thank y'all.
Get 2 hours with
me.
Quick, man.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah.
yo.
I was like, damn, we just got on the air. What the
hell? 2 hours? That's crazy. Yeah, but I had a blast, you know what I mean? And like I said, you know, thank y'all for having me. Thank y'all for the support. You know, when the new joint comes out, as long as y'all have me, I'm around. You know, it's my honor, it's my privilege to do. So I had a blast just sitting here, you know, walking out memory lane with y'all. That's what's up, you know?
Man,
yep,
it's going to be.
You're definitely welcome to come back anytime in the future. We definitely going to, in the meantime, we're going to push that live for you. And I'm going to, when we get the interview on YouTube, I'm going to send that to your management so that way y'all can have a copy of it as well. I'm going to send the download version anyway.
I appreciate it, bro. That's real talk. I appreciate it. Yeah, definitely. You know, so, yeah, like I said, when the new joint come out, you know, I spin back around. We got to bug out some more. Real quick, my social media, because I know my manager's like, you always forget. But my Instagram's Mike Geronimo. My Twitter's Real Mike Geronimo. Facebook fan page, Mike Geronimo. You could go to the website, www.MikeGeronimoMusic.com. The album 3016, it'll be out summertime, spring this year. Shout out to DJ Toon, shout out to Pete Rock, Nature, Nipsey Hussle, Scarface, Mr. Lee, Lil Durk, Ja Rule, Royal Flush,
Kid Rock,
little bit. Nah, that's why I went and got Jimmy Boyle. That's why I went and got my man Jimmy Boyle. I'm actually ecstatic about that because for people who don't know, Jimmy Boyle played a big part in Jagged Little Pill for Alanis Morissette, and he played a very big part in Under the Bridge by Red Hot Chili Peppers. Yeah, and I just got, we working together now, we in the studio, so to be able to work with somebody who's so legendary in a genre of music outside of my own, it's amazing. But shout out to Jimmy Boyle, and I got a lot of surprises, and it's going to be a nice way to end it all. I'm going to leave it at that, you know, it's going to be a nice way. Shout out to my manager. Oh, Shampoo, shout out to my YMVS family, and shout out to my sis, my manager, my mom, Allie, and yeah, it's getting ready to go down.
Definitely, man. Once again, another incredible chapter of Off the Cuff Radio with our legendary distinguished guest Mike Geronimo. This has been absolutely monumental, incredible. Once again, we thank all of our listeners out there for the support. We thank you as one of the guests we've had in our incredible history, which we're still building that legacy. King, take us out of here.
Definitely, man. On that note, we up out of here. Big salute to you again, Mike Geronimo, for stopping by and chopping up with us. Big salute to Pittsburgh Pat for getting us Royal Flush for the coming month. And big shout out to everybody that supported us along the way. And we out.
Thank yep. you. Thanks for having me, guys. I had a blast.
Thank you. Until next time, we out. Peace.